Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
You know, we've got survey information, we've got satellite data in some cases, even FSA data for certain crops can come into play this early in the season. So a lot of different data sources, a lot of data points, a lot of survey responses. And so certainly a lot of information to wade through, probably the most information anybody's got out there about the acreage growing for these various crops.
Lance Honig is chief of the crops branch of USDA's National Ag Statistics Service.
We do look at some satellite imagery. Now, there are certain parts of the country that this year in particular that might be more helpful than others because planting was pretty early in a lot of places, and therefore those crops were likely to be up and growing and easier to identify from a satellite.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Oh, I think we're still dealing with some of them. I mean, certain commodities, in the supermarket, whether it be the fruits and vegetables or some of the meat products or, flour, because of the inflationary pressures plus supply chain challenges have increased.
Talking about ongoing supply chain issues, a farmer from California, also a member of the House Ag Committee in Washington, D.C., Jim Costa.
But now some of them are starting to go down. Of course, with eggs, the avian flu is a big factor. The thing is that we had some real dislocations when we closed restaurants and we closed schools. I didn't realize, for example, that 70% of Americans eat their bacon and pork bellies in restaurants. So you close restaurants and, you think people eat bacon at home, but it's a small percentage of the overall. And everybody, a lot of folks like their bacon, but the fact is that we've had dislocation in prices at the grocery store, and we've seen an increase in the menus of our favorite restaurants affected that way. But I think we're getting through it. I think markets are beginning to settle down and normalize, and obviously it's critical that we provide healthy, nutritious food on America's dinner table every night.
But did we learn anything from the last time the supply chains melted down? South Dakota Representative Dusty Johnson had a front row seat.
We did learn lessons, and Congress also, I know we have a tendency to think of Congress as just people who can't shoot straight, but there were some things we've done with the supply chain that made a big difference. I was the author, along with John Garamendi, of California, of the Ocean Shipping Reform Act. It really is holding these ocean carriers, foreign flagged ocean carriers, accountable for how they have not been giving American agricultural exports a fair shake. I had the chairman of the Federal Maritime Commission in my office today talking about what a big impact my bill has had on helping that supply chain heal. We're not exactly where we need to be. We've got some work to go yet, but man, we have made a lot of progress.
When we talk about West Coast ports, those are vital for export of U.S. commodities. And Johnson explains.
Long Beach and the Port of L.A., there have been a lot of improvements to those ports. More are coming. But it is, my bill did address the fact that you had these foreign flagged ocean carriers who are bringing in iPhones and other high value products from Asia. They would unload, they would have American agricultural products on the dock. And they would not put them into the ship. Instead, they would turn around and they'd hurry back to Asia so they could turn around on more iPhones because they could make more money that way. Well, listen, I love the free market as much as anybody, but I got to tell you, when you're using American ports, when you are using the American marketplace to be able to have a market for off-takers of these Asian goods, you do have an obligation of reciprocity to be willing to take American corn, beans, dairy, protein, and get it back to Asia where there were willing buyers. And my bill made it clear to those guys they got to play fair. It moved us in the right direction in a big way.
South Dakota Representative Dusty Johnson, a member of the House Ag Committee. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We looked at national yields for corn, soybeans, and wheat, and what we see is yields are increasing at the same rate today as they have in the past 10 to 20 years.
Dr. Gary Schnittke is a University of Illinois ag economist looking at non-decreasing national yield trends.
For corn, we began seeing yields increase in the late 1930s or early 1940s. Since that point in time, we have seen yields increase at roughly a 1.9 bushel increase per year. And that 1.9 bushel increase is looking at that entire time frame. If we divide those time frames up into 20-year periods and look at those versus earlier versus later, we do not see yields falling below that national yield trend in recent years. We saw those yield trend increases above 1.9 in the early 1970s, decreasing a bit in the 1995, and then increasing, and right now they're close to 1.9. Last year we had a bit lower yield because that 20 years includes the last 3 years, which have been below yield trend. Overall, though, you would conclude that the yields on corn are increasing roughly at 1.9 bushels per year. For soybeans, we also look at yield trends increases, and USDA or NASS began reporting those yields in 1924. Since that point in time, yields on soybeans have been increasing, and between 1995 and 2022, those yields have been increasing at roughly a 0.42 bushel increase per year. If anything, those yield increases have been increasing in recent years, and we've seen soybean yields above trend since 2014. Recent advances in soybean technology, such as soil inoculants, as well as planting soybeans earlier, likely lead to those yield increases. But for soybeans, if anything, we see yield increases increasing rather than decreasing. For wheat, from 1950 to 2022, the average yield increase was 0.41. That has varied around, but in recent years, we are very close to that 0.41 bushel increase average. As we look at these three yield series, we find no evidence that yield trends are decreasing. There have been concerns that yield trends may be decreasing due to climate change or the adverse impacts of climate change in recent years, or because technological change may be slowing. It is true that technological change may be masking detrimental impacts of climate change, but when we look at yield trends for U.S. corn, soybeans, and wheat, we saw no evidence that yield trends are decreasing.
Now, the administrator of the Farm Service Agency is Zach Ducheneau.
Everybody's opportunity to stay on the farm is dictated by available revenue. So these are revenue-based approaches, and we really think that we're onto something with this model, because folks that take advantage of the revenue-based approach in ERP2 do commit to a linkage requirement to NAP or risk management strategies if they're available. Now, if we're able to get those more and more of those producers to use those opportunities, that revenue-based model won't be so prevalent, but it'll still be there for those that don't have them.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Glad to be the chairman of the Subcommittee on Forestry and Agriculture, and that has direct oversight of U.S. Forest Service, which is a big part of the problem of them not moving at what we call the pace and scale they should be on managing those lands.
Farmer from Northern California, member of the House Ag Committee, Doug LaMalfa.
So many of the fires that start in those lands become giant conflagrations, you know, which the Dixie Fire 2 years ago burned 1 million acres in my district. It kind of picked up where the campfire, which burned Paradise, it started just a few miles from the origin of the campfire. It burned north, and the campfire one burned more or less west and devoured about 90% of the town of Paradise. The Dixie Fire burned about 75% of the town of Greenville and all the town of Canyon Dam nearby. And there's so many of these stories. You know, we had the Beckwith Fire farther over in the east that, you know, ate a lot of houses over there and property. And, of course, all these are burning up the people's assets, their national forests. And the downside, not only that of them being gone, is the loss of habitat, the wildlife, the effect it has on our watersheds with all the ash, and then later erosion. You know, when you lose all this, you get erosion on these hills, and so it turns into mud and gets into streams and gets eventually into the water supply in some of our lakes. In some cases, it could even block the ability for the hydroelectric plants to operate as it blocks off the penstock. So positive forest management has so many good things to it. The only thing it doesn't please is the environmental groups that don't seem to want any of it to happen.
Talks about listening sessions.
Well, as a member of the Ag Committee, we've been active getting around the country having a lot of listening sessions. Our chairman, G.T. Thompson, has been doing an excellent job of coordinating and pulling that together. I've been on several of the stops, not every single one, but Pennsylvania and Connecticut and Texas and Oregon, Central California. Some of these are also hearings on forestry as well, so I'm kind of blending them. But it's all important to the product that we need to get out this year. We don't want to have a failure in getting the farm bill. So Chairman Thompson and all of us are very focused on being successful getting something out of the House, maybe by the end of July, and that'll give enough time before the turns into a pumpkin in September, at the end of September. And because we don't want that to lapse. If it lapses, then we have to either do a stopgap temporary measure, or if it reverts back to the law, the bill not being renewed, then it goes back to 30s Dust Bowl era type backup legislation, which won't be very good for anybody the way that works. So we're optimistic that we're going to get there. There doesn't seem to be any pushback from any groups on going forward. We have to get Democrats and Republicans to agree on it. The Dems are always really focused on the social side of it, meaning the SNAP program, which is about 82% of the funding of the Farm Bill. And, it needs to be renewed as well, and we need to do a good job of that. But like any program, it's also proper for us to look at are things needed to make it work better, and the people that are truly eligible are the ones that benefit best. Then, other parts would include the conservation piece and actually the production ag part, which is what keeps farmers farming. And, crop insurance is very important. Disaster relief is offset if you have more and more crop insurance. More specialty crops want to be included in that. We want to have a good safety net for that. Our walnut growers from California, for example, had a really bad year last year, so we want to have them be able to be in the safety net so they don't have to come hat in hand for help on recovering from that. So we're helping them right now, but going forward, you just want to have a strong net for everybody.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
They do that delivery. It's called debt trap diplomacy.
Arkansas Representative Rick Crawford is a member of the House Ag Committee on China.
And here's why it bothers me and why I'm concerned. And I'll give you what could be maybe the worst case scenario when you look at, for example, our protein sector. We already see that there's significant market share that is in the hands of the Chinese. JBS, for example, is a Brazilian company. It's an international global company, but it's Brazilian owned. Well, if they engage in debt trap diplomacy elsewhere in the region, stands to reason they'll engage in that practice in Brazil. Now, Brazil is part of the BRICS compact, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. And so they already have that sort of alignment with China. If for some reason they become beholden to the Chinese and they are highly leveraged and that could happen, there is the real possibility that a JBS could become part of or a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese Communist Party. And that would really be bad for the U.S. in terms of market share, total market share in the protein sector. It would be predominantly Chinese. That's one example. That may be an extreme example. Could it happen? Maybe. We'll see. Brazil is a little, it's certainly a stronger economy than what you might see in, say, Costa Rica. However, that leverage potential still exists. And so, that's something that I watch and think about a lot is not just leveraging the smaller countries for strategic purposes, for example, trying to gain a foothold in our hemisphere with regard to a port. But I'm thinking about, the possibility for them to leverage control of a significant player in an industry like agriculture, and that's an example.
Another issue dealing primarily with ag is ad hoc disaster programs.
There's a variety of things we could do to address the ad hoc disaster scenarios that come up. One is probably a broader application of farm or crop insurance, taking more of a whole farm approach, requiring that as an eligibility requirement to participate in ad hoc disaster relief programs. A lot of people that do make that investment in crop insurance feel like they're being treated unfairly because in a disaster scenario, people that have not purchased farm our crop insurance in many cases are eligible and maybe first in line to actually receive ad hoc disaster relief. And so that's where I think we all need to be singing from the same hymnal with regard to how we manage risk as it applies to natural disasters, number one. Number two, I think there's some things we can do outside of the scope of the Ag Committee that relates to better managing those disasters. One is a bill that we've been working for actually since I got here, and that is to create self-funded disaster relief accounts. They're much like an HSA that people use to manage their health care, but it would be used to manage unexpected occurrences on your farm, tax incentives to fund those accounts, withdraw the money for operational purposes at no tax penalty. And so it does resemble an HSA, but it's designed to help provide immediate relief to farmers. If and when an ad hoc disaster relief measure is taken, sometimes it takes a long time to deliver. Crop insurance adjustments sometimes can take a long time to deliver. Well, if you're able to fund that in the interim until one or both of those scenarios kick in, at least that's the difference maker in keeping you in business for another year versus maybe going out of business. And so I think we can put a few more tools in the tool shed for farmers to use.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Typical cattle corrals or working pens have got some fundamental components.
Dr. Mark Johnson is an Oklahoma State beef breeding specialist on managing pens and working facilities.
We're going to have the catch pens where whenever we first gather cattle out of pastures, we're going to be in those pens. We're going to have some probably wider sorting alleys out of those. Eventually, we're going to work into a crowding area. Crowding areas, we're going to talk more about next week. There's a couple different options on crowding areas, but more details on that next week. Eventually, the purpose of our crowding out or crowding system is to get cattle into an alleyway or what we commonly refer to as a crowding alley, which is a means of getting them to the actual squeeze chute with a head catch system on it. Something like we're looking at here to my right as we shoot this week. Now, we can also have a loadout coming out of that alleyway, and that is another important part of the corral or working system itself. So those are the basic components. One of the things that's really important to think about is just normal cattle behavior. Several things to keep in mind. Typically, cattle process one thought at a time. They're an intelligent creature, but they tend to think about one thing at a time, and they instinctively want to see us whenever we're around them. They want to go by us if we're in the vicinity together. They want to go back to where they have came from, and they want to go with other cattle or be with other cattle. Thinking about normal cattle behavior is an important part of putting together a good facility. And if we think through that process and design it right, we can manage to decrease the likelihood of injury to cattle or humans. We can reduce the amount of stress on the cattle. We can manage to work cattle in a fashion where we need them to go is kind of their idea and capitalize on those instinctual behaviors of the cattle to get them to do what we need them to do. Another important consideration is location. And we need to look at our particular layout of farm and ranch. Think about where pastures converge, so we've got a central catch point. Working facilities are an expensive, long-term investment. We don't want to build more of them than what we need, but if we're looking at, say, a quarter section, half section, a one section pasture, and we've got that divided up into grazing paddocks, and we might be able to put in one working system instead of putting in multiple working systems, obviously, we're going to be able to invest in it, plan it better, and have a central point that's more convenient to catch cattle. topography and just elevation of where we build a set of pens is very important. We need good drainage. We need that we're not going to be in standing water and catch a lot of manure over time. And so even if we have to backfill with some extra dirt or bring in a few loads of rock or gravel, it is worth getting that elevation, the slope draining off of it just right for the long-term benefit, so we can get trucks and trailers in there in inclement weather and be moving cattle around as we need to without being bogged down in a lot of mud and slop. Final consideration as far as location, give thoughts to where people are living, where your house is. It may not seem like a big deal 360 some days a year, but if we end up building a corral too close to our residence, flies, noise, things like that during times of really heavy use can get to be a headache for us.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One of the things that I really tried to make sure to do after I was fortunate enough to be reelected is the Farm Bill is a must-pass piece of legislation. And like the House, of course, and the Congress as a whole, we take up tons of important legislation. I always say if the Congress is working on it's important.
She represents the 3rd Congressional District of Kansas. Sharice Davids, a member of the House Ag Committee.
That while that's true for everything, it's also true that there's some bills that are so consequential that they fall into the like must-pass category, and I would say the Farm Bill is absolutely one of those, right up there with like funding the federal government, in part because, the things like crop insurance, and then of course the nutrition assistance side of the bill are just, they're so impactful for so many people. And during my time on the Ag Committee in this session of Congress, I have spent the first part of this year doing what we're just calling a Farm Bill listening tour. Keep it simple. And I've had the chance to visit with we have so many producers in the 3rd District. We have 5 counties. We've got everything from row crops and, decent size, not as many as like Western Kansas, but decent size farms with row crops. And then everything from that to our specialty crop, smaller farmers and producers. We also are like, we're so impacted by the, impacts of severe weather events. We're impacted by things like the pandemic, which, a lot of folks were really trying to navigate. So I do think that makes the Farm Bill this year, it's always important, but it feels very, very important for us to get that thing across the finish line in a timely way this year.
Also talks about having National Crop Insurance Services in her district.
It's interesting because before I got onto the Ag Committee, I only knew about a little bit about the nutrition assistance programs, of course. I also knew about crop insurance to some extent in that it is such an important backstop for so many farmers and producers in our country. And with the headquarters there in the 3rd District, I actually got the chance to learn about that a bit earlier than the most recent time I've been serving on the Ag Committee. But I do think that hopefully it'll maybe put some minds at ease that I feel like we've got a really strong support for not just maintaining the crop insurance program, but making sure that we're being really thoughtful about some of the farmers and producers that might be in the specialty crop space, making sure that we're not taking away from the crop insurance program at all or making it more difficult or any of that sort of thing. And then also just making sure that, with things like drought or flooding, which Kansas is experiencing both of those things at any given time, I feel like we're going to be able to make sure to protect that program for our growers and producers.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Minimum changes in production, several adjustments in price. The summary for USDA's June outlook for dairy. World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jankowski says most changes in production categories occurred for the current marketing year.
Milk production for 2023, we reduced 200 million pounds just based on slower anticipated growth in milk per cow.
Meanwhile, price adjustments were made for both 2023 and 2024.
One that kind of stands out is lower cheese prices for 2023. We lowered our cheese price forecast by 9 cents per pound. We also reduced our cheese price forecast for 2024, lowered it by 4 cents a pound.
The lower cheese price forecast led to a lowering of Class 3 milk prices and lower all milk prices for both years. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.